You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, May 11th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, director of the William Rhodes Center for International Economics and Finance, the William and author of the upcoming book, Angrynomics, Mark Blythe, will be joining us on the post-pandemic economy and maybe the during-pandemic economy. Meanwhile, look who's coming to dinner. White House races to contain COVID-19 in the White House. Also on the program today, the bailout is working for the rich as we head to 20% unemployment in this country. Meanwhile, Dems gear up to pass a new stimulus bill, but Republicans will be taking a little bit of a pause. White House officials will be testifying to the Senate, but they'll be doing so remotely, at least some of them, because some of them think they should be quarantining. California will now be doing vote by mail. Iran offers an unconditional prisoner swap. The Georgia AG wants a federal investigation of Ahmaud Arbery, and Hearst loses its bid to halt unionization. Meanwhile, ex-DOJ says Barr lied about her findings to exonerate Flynn. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. We will get to all that and more in just a moment. Brendan, are you there? Want to put that music down?
Yep.
All right. Got a couple of things to go, and then we will be talking to Mark Blythe about what we have happening on the economy. We got a lot of stuff to do, a lot of stuff to do quickly. Let's just start with this. The big story, of course, and I know, there's a lot of people who, I'm sure there are varied reactions to this. I mean, I just, Mike Pence told us he didn't have to wear a mask when he went to the, Mayo Clinic, because of course he's constantly test and everyone around him is tested. And, gosh, they would never, the White House, they would never jeopardize the president or the vice president. And of course, it turns out that his spokeswoman, last name Miller, oddly enough, has tested positive. She is Stephen Miller's wife. And now Stephen Miller apparently has not tested positive. He's tested negative. It's unclear if he is, he's not going back into work, but just about everybody else is. Now, the doctors, Redfield and Fauci and Stephen Hahn, who's the FDA, they've decided to hang back from the White House from there, presumably because they don't want to send the wrong message to other medical personnel. But as far as the White House is concerned, they're trying to push this idea that there's no problem. We can open up the the infection, the disease is going to go away. And as long as we save the economy, we'll all be fine. And apparently a lot of the people in the White House are freaking out now. I don't want to lie and say that this did not bring a smile to my face, but it did. When I read this graph, this is from the New York Times. Mr. Trump continues to reject guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to wear a mask when meeting with groups of people. But a senior administration official said the president was spooked that his valet, who is among those who serve him food, that is just a disgusting thought, had not been wearing a mask. And he was annoyed to learn that Ms. Miller tested positive, has been growing irritated with people who get too close to him, the official said. Here's Donald Trump sharing the news that the White House staff is now infected.
Volume. You're muted.
I don't know much about it. Any questions, John?
Can you bring us up to speed about the member of the vice president's staff who is now testing positive for coronavirus? This is now the second staffer in the West Wing.
Yeah. Well, I don't know much about it. Does anybody want to talk about it? She's a wonderful young woman, Katie. She tested very good for a long period of time, and then all of a sudden today she tested positive. She hasn't come into contact with me. Spend some time with the vice president. I believe the press person, right? You'd say press person. She tested positive out of the blue. This is why the whole concept of tests aren't necessarily great. The tests are perfect, but something can happen between a test where it's good and then something happens and all of a sudden she was tested very recently and tested negative. And then today, I guess, for some reason, she tested positive. So Mike knows about it, and Mike has done what he has to do. I think he is on an airplane going to some faraway place, but you'll be able to ask him later on. But they've taken all of the necessary precautions. I understand Mike has been tested, vice president, and he tested negative.
Yeah, but what good are tests, right?
This whole idea... This guy's such an effing idiot. It's unbelievable. Or he's just so freaked that he doesn't even have the ability to be in any way comprehensible. Or I should say coherent. You know what's weird, too, about this? I mean, look, obviously, you know, the low-hanging fruit here is that the moron doesn't seem to understand. That's why you test every day. Because people can catch it afterwards. And I also love the fact that she clearly has not been adhering to any guidelines, that she and Stephen Miller have been doing whatever they want. And I love that. I think that's wonderful. I think Mike Pence might be on the verge of getting me to believe in some fashion of God if he keeps this up. But I love the fact that he also speaks of her. She's a great person, even though she had a bad test. Like this, it's like almost in the same way they talk about people who are living in poverty. Like there's some type of moral repudiation that is going on because they have tested for COVID-19. It's fascinating. And of course, you know, Mike is on a plane going somewhere far away. What?
What good are negative tests if they don't tell you if you're ever going to get it or not?
If you can't, I don't know, I thought this was supposed to see into your future. It was a future test. Folks, this ad is a warning. Our democracy is under attack from the U.S. Supreme Court. In the middle of a deadly global pandemic, people across Wisconsin were planning on voting absentee to keep themselves and their families safe. But the night before the election, five Republican justices on the Supreme Court told thousands of people they'd have to choose between risking their lives and forfeiting their right to vote. Supreme Court favoring Republican interests over our democracy is nothing new. They gutted the Voting Rights Act. They invited billionaires and corporations to spend unlimited amounts trying to influence elections. They gave a green light to gerrymandering, voter ID laws, voter roll purges, and now a progressive movement is rising up to fight back, because it's quite possible the Wisconsin case will not be the last 2020 showdown over voting rights to be settled in the courts. We simply cannot trust this court to put aside partisan views and protect people's right to vote. Our courts are becoming too political. It's time to say enough. Learn more about how you can join the fight by visiting demandjustice.org/majority. That's demandjustice.org/majority. And folks, as you know, I am not the most adept shopper of clothes. I don't know what goes together. I don't particularly like to shop for clothes. But I have found a far more convenient and comfortable way for me to do so. Talking about Stitch Fix, it's a personal styling company, makes you get the clothes you love effortless. Bingo. It's a completely different way to shop. It's all about you every time. To get started, go to stitchfix.com/majority to set up your profile, and they'll deliver you great looks personalized just for you in your colors, styles, and budget. I think I'm an autumn. I don't know. I don't even know what that means. You pay a $20 styling fee for each fix, which is credited towards anything you keep. You can schedule at any time. There's no subscription required. Plus, shipping, returns, and exchanges are easy and free. Stitch Fix does the hard work for you, making great styles effortless for everybody, including men, women, and kids. I'm going on there. I'm going to buy my summer clothes through Stitch Fix. I got that Pilsen Thermal Crew. It's the only thing that I've been traveling with, being out of town. I love that thing, but it's starting supposedly to get warm. It actually snowed the other day, and I've got my eyes on these sneaker. It says they have limited stock, so I'm a little bit hesitant to say anything about it before I actually buy it. But it's a brown, sort of leathery, you know, a brownish leathery kind. It's a grown-up sneaker. Brendan, I will let you know about this. Brendan's my other like Stitch Fix stylist. He has to okay everything that the first stylist okays. But it's good. And if you don't like the stylist you got, you get a different one. If you don't like what they picked out for you, you reject it. It's awesome. You can get started today at stitchfix.com/majority. You get 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. That's stitchfix.com/majority for 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. stitchfix.com/majority. We will put links to both these things in the YouTube and our podcast description. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Mark Blythe, William R. Rhodes, 57, Professor of International Economics, Professor of Political Science and International and Public Affairs, author of the upcoming book, Angrynomics. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the director of the William R. Rhodes Center for International Economics and Finance and the William Rhodes Professor of International Economics and Professor of Political Science, International and Public Affairs at Brown, author of the upcoming book, Angrynomics. Mark Blythe, welcome back to the program.
Great to be back. That's a hell of a mouthful on those titles. I need to get shorter titles.
It's pretty impressive stuff. I was actually just in the middle of reading that. I was thinking, like, I got to get something like this. But I guess you need to be a little bit more, a little smarter and a little bit more suited to academic work. But all right, with that said, I want us to start here because I think the first time you and I spoke was probably back in like 2013. Maybe it was a little bit before then, but we were talking about the pivot to austerity that we were seeing in this country, following the pivot to austerity that we saw in Europe. And I may be jumping ahead of myself a little bit here in terms of, but we are already starting to hear, it's coming from the White House, but on some level, it's also coming from Nancy Pelosi, which should not be that much of a surprise because she's a Pete Peterson acolyte. She wanted to do PAYGO. We're starting to already hear concerns that if we spend too much, we're going to ruin the economy. Like, what is going on that there is no understanding about where the economy is right now? I mean, it's fascinating. We have this sort of disparity between the stock market and everything else seems to be irrelevant. And the fact that the stock market is okay seems to be the only thing that matters.
Well, put it this way. If you're part of that top 5% of people who own basically all the stocks, that is all that matters. So let's think about what Congress did on both sides. Everybody's guilty on this one. And it contains some good stuff. But let's think about what they did. The Fed comes out and basically says, oh my God, this is going to crush everything. If 70% of people basically have to go home, consumer spending collapses. Consumer spending is 80% of economic output in the US. We're screwed. So everyone starts to panic. They start to dump stocks. They start to dump bonds. Everything's going down. So the Fed comes in with a huge number of programs, puts a floor under asset prices, basically says it's not going to fall any further, you're good. Then the CARES Act comes along. CARES Act comes along and says, hey, we've got to basically bail out businesses. Oh, yeah, we've got to look after people as well. So we'll give all these airlines that did all these buybacks lots of cash. We'll give cruise lines bailouts. We'll do all this sort of stuff. And, you know, we don't expect businesses to have savings or their own cash. That would be ridiculous. So we'll give them all this cash. That's great. And we'll make sure it happens really fast. Absolutely. No problem. We'll give ordinary people checks because, of course, that's a 21st century technology. I mean, we could put Treasury direct accounts. We could pay people through the phone, whatever. But we'll do checks. The imaginary here in this whole thing was that we're going to take this as a moment to basically make sure that our portfolios are okay. And then the virus should be fine. We'll be gone. It'll all be gone by summer. And then they can get back to work. And if we've given them $1,200, we're fine. Now the enormity of this is beginning to dawn on them. They've realized they've bailed out themselves and their portfolios, but the economy isn't just a question of let's turn it on and see if it goes again. Because this virus thing is a lot more difficult, a lot more troublesome than we thought. It's not going away in the summer. There might not be a vaccine anytime soon. And even when you open up, as we're beginning to see in states across the country, you've got a kind of inverse field of dreams problem. You could open it, but will they come? And it turns out the answer is no. So in those circumstances, suddenly the Austerians are coming back going, well, this isn't just temporary. We can't go on spending like this forever. What's going to happen to the national debt? This is terrible. And the same old arguments come out again.
The national debt, I mean, it's stunning. It's stunning because it's absurd. But all right, I want to just walk through some of this. What happens? So we have this this lending program by the Fed, right? I mean, they went in and they shored up asset prices, but we have this lending program where trillions of dollars are available to corporations to borrow money at basically 0% interest, right? And they should all be able to make money off of that, right? I mean, if either one of us got $1 billion for free and we could keep it for, I mean, are there terms on this? Like, how long? Is it a year? Do we know? Or will the Fed keep kicking it down the road? Because obviously you can make money by just, I don't know, I could put $1 billion in a CD for that matter. And I wouldn't have to have, and I would make my living probably off of that easily. But what happens when they've got to pay it back and the economy is still in shambles?
So it's not a payback question. Essentially what they're doing is it's just what we did in the financial crisis. All mortgages aren't bad. but mortgages are considered bad. So the Fed buys mortgages, swaps them out for cash. Then the people with the cash buy other things, and that trickle down starts an economy. That was, in a sense, what the Fed did. This is a version of the same thing. Think about the problem of an airline, right? So an airline makes money when it flies at 90% capacity. Just now they're lucky if they've got 9% capacity. Half the money that they got was to not cause redundancies amongst their labor force, and all that lasts through until September. But it is literally impossible for them to make any money because nobody's getting on a plane. So this isn't a loan. Essentially what you're doing is you're giving them that money. Half of it's going to payroll protection. The other half of it is helping the operating costs of a very large complex organization that has no savings because it basically remunerated its management at such a high level. And everybody's hoping that the whole thing goes away in 3 months. Well, that's not going to happen.
Well, what about the Main Street Lending Program? I guess that's what I'm asking. Like, obviously, with the bailout for the kind that we're talking about for the airlines, that's, you know, more or less, I guess, the equivalent of the PPP, but for bigger companies and easier for them to get. But for the Main Street Lending Program, it seems to me that there's this problem that they are giving these corporations, you know, providing them liquidity, and the assumption is, I think, is that they're going to, be able to pay the Fed back. Will the Fed just keep punting if the economy? I mean, I just don't see how this is. At one point, we're going to hit this understanding that like 20 to 30 million people are unemployed, and none of the things are going to work.
Well, you know, that's the real issue. I mean, let's think about the small business program, right? So we've been basically dissing government in this country for the past 40 years. Anybody who works for the government's a loser. You should be in the rough and tumble of the private sector. You've been cutting pay, you've been cutting taxes, you've been crushing morale, you haven't been investing in anything. So the Small Business Association usually deals with about maybe, I don't know, it's like 10,000 applications and inquiries in a week across the whole U.S. Suddenly you declare that there's going to be this paycheck protection and also corporate relief for small businesses. Suddenly they get hit with a million claims in a week. Their systems are completely overloaded. They break down. You bring in the consultants. They're trying to basically open up something the size of a drinking straw and turn it into a fire hose. What you said earlier about the Fed was bang on. The Fed knows how to give money to banks. Banks know how to give money to big corporations. None of that has anything to do with small businesses. So even if you discount the politics, simply trying to get the plumbing in this country to work, to do what it says on the tin, is extremely difficult. We give money to banks. We do not give money to small businesses. We never built that plumbing.
So when does this begin to fall apart? I mean, when does the... Is it possible the stock market continue to sort of just rise? I mean, it's funny because for a long time, you know, there's been many people who say, like, you know, the stock market is not an indication of the economy. On Friday, the market recovers, and on the announcement of 20 million people who are unemployed. I mean, that's just bizarre. I don't think that we've heard on CNBC. This is proof that we've been, you know, the stock market has nothing to do with the economy. But when does it begin to impact the stock market? And I guess I'm interested, basically, because that seems to be the only time where there's any sense of urgency. And so, you know, and I want to pivot to what, you know, we're talking about in terms of legislation coming up. But right now, the Democrats seem to have waited to the point where, you know, it's like we're about to bring out the main course, and the Republicans have already eaten, as far as they're concerned. They push themselves away from the table, and I just want to know when they come back, because it's not until the stock market starts to take a dive that I think we're going to see any type of leverage for the Democrats at that point.
Yeah, I think you're right. So I mean, if you go back to the financial crisis, people forget that when Bear Stearns went under, there was a whole narrative about how there was the one bad apple and everything's fine now. And then for the next 2 months, the markets went up until they completely melted down. Now, at that point, there wasn't this kind of Fed help to keep a floor under the prices, but we'll see how strong that floor is. Ultimately, what a stock market represents, even tangentially, is the future discounted cash flows of businesses that are listed with shares. If at the end of the day, those businesses aren't making any money because the workers won't go back to work, because the malls are open but they're bankrupt because no one can pay their rent, etc., etc., then you got a problem. You cannot maintain that level of share price if the cash flows coming at the business have collapsed. So ultimately, there is a connection, but just now it's kind of flying in a bit of a kind of virtual gravity, which is basically because of the Fed and the floor that they've put on asset prices.
All right. So give me a sense of from legislatively at this point, the Democrats have announced that they're going to come out with, I guess this is CARES 3. They're going to try and pass it in the House. It's going to be primarily for cities and municipalities and states, which they desperately need. But also there's supposedly going to be expanded unemployment, but they're really concerned about overpaying people. You got to be very, right. You got to watch out for that, which is just, I don't know. I mean, it's just insanity. And
well, what that tells you is how little people were getting paid, right? I mean, if you can actually overpay someone when they're on unemployment, the counterfactual is, my God, how little were they getting paid when they were employed?
Right, exactly. And that apparently is not a worry of anybody in Congress at this point. They are looking for $25 billion to keep the U.S. Postal Service afloat, which the Republicans, I think, very craftily made that one of their asks, right?
Right.
And as far as I can tell, there isn't anything about voting, but maybe I'm just reading about you know, what they're looking for from an economic standpoint. Supposedly they're going to pass this and the Republicans aren't going to do anything because they want to pause and see what happens as the money filters through. And I'm also now reading that the PPP, there's still about 40% of the funds are left because all the requests seem to have dried up. And I don't know if that's because people didn't know they could get it or they just already had to lay off their people. But give me your sense of where we stand now and then what we should be doing.
No, I think that you summarized it right. The Democrats, as ever, never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. So they went along with the first one, which is essentially a giant corporate bailout so that they could at least get something for ordinary people. And they managed to do that. But at the same time, it was done through checks. Some of those haven't even filtered through yet. And the amount isn't going to pay the mortgage, all the rest of it. The fundamental problem, the way that they imagined the problem is, and you notice the language that gets used every time, is like, we need another version of the New Deal. Something like Franklin Bloody Roosevelt is like invoked every time. That was 90 years ago. Can we get a grip on this stuff? Right? The notion that we're going to take millions of people in the middle of a viral pandemic and put them in a new version of the WPA, stick them in the desert in tent cities and get them to build a dam, that's not really what the problem is just now. So there's this incredible disconnect between the imaginary of the top Democrats and what they think they should do and what the reality of this needs to be. And the reality of this needs to be, hang on a minute, we've got a pandemic. What does that mean? It means that everybody's individual risk is multiplied by the more that they contact anybody else. So the risk is at the level of the system, not the individual. And we're finding this out the hard way by reopening all the rest of it. We need to be basically thinking of policies that allow people to basically stay in place, but at the same time are able to actually spend. We should be able to think about openings in ways that people who are far less likely to be infected or to bring those infections back are able to do that, which is all about contact testing and tracing and all the rest of it, which is the stuff that we're totally dropping the ball on. So the Republicans, you're quite right, have said, hey, we've had our bailout. Screw you. We're not getting anything else. As far as they're concerned with bailing out the states, states always have hard budget constraints. Some even have balanced budget amendments for politics that we know why. There's actually a Fed facility that people don't really know about, which has been increased, which allows states and municipalities to basically borrow to help them over this period. The Democrats might be able to get something through that will do something on the state level, because essentially it's states running the show. We're asking them to fight a pandemic in the absence of really help or strategy from the federal government. while at the same time furloughing their employees and slashing their budgets. That's clearly nonsensical. So there may be something that comes through this. But in terms of sort of how the Democrats think about this, everything's stuck in this 1930s New Deal imaginary, which is completely inappropriate for where we are today.
All right. Well, I want to talk about that, because it seems to me like that you obviously can't do that now, but we're obviously going to need to do something like that later. I'm hesitant to say, like, at what point can we do that? I don't think we have a sense yet. I think we're about to get a sense of when we can't do it. But in the meantime, it's just basically keeping people afloat, right?
Right. That's exactly it. But here's your problem, right? At the end of the day, the version of capitalism that America has is kind of like just in time. There's no airbags, there's no buffers, right? Except in extreme emergencies, and then they're only temporary. This place is not designed to be shut down. It only works if everybody works. And now we've got a situation whereby this virus, if it's around for the next 18 months, you can say goodbye to half of the restaurants in the United States ever opening again. You've got 80 million hourly employees that tend to work in close contact positions. Everything from people who are working in slaughterhouses, literally elbow to elbow with each other in highly infectious environments, to restaurants, to massage parlors, to a whole host of different types of things where you're in close contact with people. All of that is now at risk. And the weird thing about this is it's not as if it's a war. People keep using this metaphor of the war against the virus. In a war, your capital, the stuff that you make stuff with, is destroyed. Your factories are blown up. Your houses are demolished, as well as people dying. Here, we're in a bizarre world where all of the capital is exactly where we left it in March. It's just that we can't go back to it. And if we go back to it and try and use it the same way we did before, it probably won't work. So that's a unique problem, which is why I think it's sort of like this old imaginary of we need a new deal. It's completely irrelevant.
It is bizarre where what's happening in the economy is sort of like a second order issue and I guess it's getting that type of attention, right? I mean, can we just survive in this holding pattern if we do have, like, you know, it just seems like things like, okay, they're punting, like, for instance, in New York, you can't evict somebody until a June or July. I can't remember when it is. And I imagine at one point Cuomo's going to have to say, actually, you can't evict anybody until September. And then it's conceivable in September, they're going to say you can't evict anybody till January. Like, there's all this sort of, it's like musical chairs on some level. And
let's take that example to the other side, right? So the people who are renting apartments to people who no longer have any income, let's say that they or their partner has already been laid off, so their income's down. So those mortgage payments aren't made. So those mortgage payments aren't made start to, like, not get, go into the banks and go into the credit instruments. That impairs the credit markets even further. A big firm gets downgraded. That panics the market. Everything's connected.
And right now I know there's a program for mortgage borrowers to punt, essentially. I think it's 3 months down the road. And I imagine they're going to extend that too. And I imagine the Fed is basically buying up a lot of those bonds, right? I mean, it's Fannie and Freddie buying in, and then the Fed's sort of financing that. And this is just...
Yeah, the Fed is basically plugging the liquidity gaps. Although, as far as I know, and I could be wrong on this one, what should happen with the mortgage program is you forget 3 months and put it on the end of the loan. And what lenders are actually saying is you can forget 3 months, but you need to give us 4 months in 4 months' worth 4 months from now, which isn't doing anybody any good at all.
Right. Of course, because banks are, these guys just want their fees up front and they don't want.
Because they're on the hook to somebody else.
Right.
Right. Because they borrowed the money from somebody else. It's this whole chain of everybody owes everybody else.
How are we going to get out of this?
Great difficulty.
I'm trying to because there just seems to be this delusion that the virus is going to go away. And, you know, you and I are not epidemiologists, but I think, like, at this point, you don't need to be, you know, like, I'm also not a physicist, but I know that gravity works. And it seems to me like that the virus is just not going to go away on its own until 60 to 70% of the population gets infected or there's a vaccine.
You got it.
And that's the only two things that can happen. And statistically speaking, that means we're going to have anywhere from 20 to, I guess, like seven, you know, or maybe a little bit less, maybe 15 to like six or five times more deaths in this country, five times more hospitalizations, infections to get to 60 to 70%. And nobody's going to go, I'm not going to a restaurant and sitting down right. and trusting that, you know, that that dude over there has my best interest in, you know.
Yeah.
And so.
But that, but this is when you got to break down the numbers, right? And then you got to prioritize where you put your health. So if you go to the Office for National Statistics website for the British government, and these are their official figures, and they may be undercounted, but we've no reason to think that they're systematically manipulated. If you look at total deaths, it's 30,000. If you look at deaths under the age of 45, it's 400. One-third of all cases happen in care homes to old people. So what should you be doing? Well, this is where the Swedes look pretty good on this one. You basically keep things open, and you encourage people to be smart about their interactions. And then you really try and keep old and vulnerable people safe. And then you basically try and control the spread to the level that you can keep economic activity going, keep people in jobs. But at the same time, you don't destroy your health service. It's a hell of a tricky balance enough, but it's the only one we've got.
Right.
And if we can, if you continue to shut down, particularly in a place where everyone depends upon wages and 40% of people live paycheck to paycheck, can't get $400 in an emergency. That emergency started 4 weeks ago. We know all the stats, right? You have to open up. But if you open up and people don't come, or if they come and then they start to do super infections and there are huge spreads and it overwhelms local health services, people get even more freaked out and withdraw even more. So this is a really tough balance in that. But ultimately, it's one that we're going to have to try and pull off. And we'll try and pull it off state by state because the federal government's worse than useless.
There really does feel like the plan here is surge, pull back, surge, pull back, surge,
yeah.
pull back until we you know enough people get infected and die. And
but also we can also put it in terms of, you know, and then if you invested in contact tracing, if you had the ability to do proper testing, then you can get those numbers down, because the minute you know there's been someone's infected, you can stop the spreading event. Right. You can also protect people who are way more vulnerable than others.
Right.
So, yes, it's absolutely true that there's a case. There's now 30 children in New York out of all the cases they have to have this weird sort of Kawasaki type syndrome of immunoresponse. Right. That is horrible and tragic. God forbid my daughter succumbs to that. But it's still a handful of people
right.
in comparison to 300 people, a million people in the United States. Right. So I don't want to play a law of numbers on this one, but you can't stay sequestered forever and expect the government just to run a printing press, because eventually the whole world will say, you know what, I don't trust the dollar anymore. We've got a long way to go before we get to that, but that is the extreme, right? And you don't want to get anywhere near that. On the other hand, if you just open it up, you blow up your economy because and your healthcare service because you've got too much spread. And the only way to do this is to get into that sweet spot in the middle.
Right, which would involve having some measure of leadership. And we have, as far as I can tell, zero. I mean, there, you know, we have some level of competency in some of the states, it seems to me, but there's a whole nother problem that comes with what you're talking about, this idea of being able to isolate the most vulnerable people, and that is lower people living in lower income
yeah.
situations. They, it's much harder just in terms of like, how do you keep, you know, you have families who are multi-generational households. How do you deal with that? Yeah, you have multi-generational households with people who need to actually go to work as opposed to work from home. That to me seems like, you know, on some
yeah.
level, the administration must, you know, if I can figure this out, that problem, the administration surely does. And it seems to me like they're just basically saying, you know what? Most of the death is going to happen in places that we just don't really care that much about.
let's be more generous. Let's assume that they cared. Let's ask the concrete question, what could they do? So how do you rehouse 10 million Americans within 6 months? That's a tough problem. Doesn't matter who's in there. This is what Obama said on that call that was leaked the other day. With any government, this would be a nightmare.
Right.
With this one, it's a particular nightmare.
Right.
So there's no good options to this. This is where you see all of the things that make America work, right? Which is people have to work. There are no safety nets. There are no airbags, right? Everybody's at full pelt the whole time. If you don't do it, someone else will do it cheaper, right? That creates a type of society, a series of inequalities that mean that people live close together. That means if you're living in cities and you're not a high earner, your living conditions are extremely cramped. All those things, which we kind of shrugged off as that's just the way we do business, have been exposed by this virus as being killers. One of the reasons the Swedes can get away with it is not just because they're a rich country. We're a rich country too. It's because they're a relatively equal country and most people live on their own. That's hugely important if you're going to tell people to basically voluntarily self-sequester. It's not clear how you do that in East New York. Right. It's not clear how you do that in parts of the Atlanta burbs.
So let's assume for a moment that we do manage to get through this, you know, by January, right? I mean, just sheer statistics, even if we do it incorrectly, 60 to 70% infection rate. I think it's like conceivable that you would get there. I don't know, with 6, 7, 8 months out, maybe a little bit longer.
No, but nobody really knows because we haven't done enough tests to know what the actual rate of infection is out there just now.
Right. But I think we can sort of extrapolate, right, from what's happened in New York in terms of testing, because they're probably testing people who are more likely to be positive than not. And so we know that it's like a maximum of like 20% in the most densely populated areas, which, you know, which means that it can be anywhere from like 5 to 15 for the rest of the country, it seems like to me. And so we're, you know, at best 1/5 through this, at worst, maybe 1/8 through this, maybe 1/10 through it, maybe in some places
But then what you're doing is you're doing this over an average. And like what happens is every single place will experience this in a different way from others. So you can generalize from New York, but New York's not going to tell you what's going to happen in Des Moines. It's not going to happen. If you've got a big meat packing plant, you're totally getting it. If you don't have a big meat packing plant, you might not get anything, right?
Right.
So the average is important, but it's kind of misleading as well. All we know is we need to make the following assumptions. What if there is no vaccine anytime soon? Then this thing becomes part of the furniture. We hope that you get to 60, 70%, as Angela Merkel said, but then there's still no guarantee of long-term immunity simply from exposure. So we're going to have to start rethinking how we do a lot of stuff. Now, this is where we can make this more positive, right? Let's go back to that example. I said, this isn't a war. We haven't destroyed all that capital. It's just sitting there. So it may be the case that massage envy is going to go to the wall. I think it will. It may be the case that a lot of retail is going to go to the wall. It was already on the way out, particularly in big malls. Does that mean everyone who ever worked in those sectors will never find a job again? Highly unlikely. Because all of that capital will be liquidated and needs to be redeployed. What does it need to be redeployed in? Well, if we want to get through this, we're going to have to do some serious investment and changes to the way that we do healthcare. Whether it's single payer or whatever system, it cannot be one that's based on private insurance tied to employment when employment collapses.
Right.
So there's lots of ways that we can think critically and positively about, yeah, this is a terrible blight and a horrible problem, but we've got a good problem because we're an incredibly rich country. We've got a bunch of capital that we can't use anymore. How do we liquidate it at the minimum cost and redeploy it into things that we need? How do we use this to further decarbonization? What new jobs can we create out of this that aren't just basically make work? Because God knows there's tons of work that needs to be done. We've been talking for 10 years about upgrading America's terrible infrastructure. Well, if now isn't the time, I don't know when is, because you're still looking at negative real interest rates on long-term debt. So get to it. What matters is leadership. And it's not just a leadership at the top and a failure of leadership at the top. It's a failure of imagination. We're so divided amongst ourselves trying to blame the other guy. We can't see the fact that there's $10 lying on the sidewalk waiting for somebody to pick it up.
Right. And what do we do about the consolidation that I think is inevitably going to come? I mean, I don't, will we be able to buy anything that is not Amazon branded in 8 months, 10 months?
Well, that's a huge issue. And like, you see the way this is working out in different countries. So in Europe, they're very concerned about consolidation, particularly by these already rich digital monopolists and private equity funds. Private equity in the US is sitting there with $1.5 trillion on the sidelines, basically making mafia offers to small businesses. Hey, buddy, you need some cash? Here's an offer you can't refuse. So they get to own everything, and the concentration goes through the roof. Mr. Bezos makes even more money, and then the rest of us still aren't forming unions and are able to fight back or claim our share of the profits. That's a very dystopian way of thinking, and it could happen that way. But it doesn't have to. I mean, at the end of the day, these are corporations. They don't have an army. They don't have a navy. And if you basically have to suffer through multiple waves of a virus and you crush 30% of employment, any politician that's got doesn't have rocks in their head is going to realize that defending the tax privileges of the billionaire class might not be a winning strategy. But then again, if you're the Democrats, you probably wouldn't do that.
Right. I mean, I there's a lot of politicians, I feel like, with rocks in their heads these days. I feel like we're maybe, I don't know, a decade or two away from politicians that will see this differently. But the problems are clear anyways. Mark Blythe.
Well, you know, let me give you something hopeful, right?
So yes,
if you remember 10 years ago when the austerity thing kicked off, it was Cameron and Osborne, the British Prime Minister and Chancellor, who were like, now we need to tighten our belts in the middle of a recession. And it was disastrous, and it impoverished hundreds of thousands of people, and it led, according to a lot of research, directly to Brexit and all the rest of it, right? Look at what happens this time. In comes Boris Johnson, and they get a new Chancellor of the Exchequer because the old guy was too fiscally conservative. And this young guy comes in and says, right, what are we facing? A giant consumption and supply shock. Okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to basically guarantee payroll for 6 months. Everybody stays in their job. Nobody gets laid off. We backstop the banks. The government, the banks front the credit to the businesses. The businesses pay paychecks as usual, and then we give it back to the banks. In 6 months' time, we'll see where we are. That's called helicopter money. That's a conservative administration in Britain doing direct payments to households alongside a now basically cooperative central bank that doesn't give a shit about inflation and really cares about basically liquidity and the stability of businesses. Even those people can make the right choices under certain circumstances.
So let me ask you this. I mean, I think, you know, Trump may be more inclined to follow that than the rest of his administration. And I'm quite convinced that, like, the Pence-ites, as it were, in that administration are going to, you know, and I think a lot of what they're doing now is just setting the table in the event that Joe Biden wins, that they can immediately pivot to, we've got problems, we got to cut Social Security type of situation.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's just the standard script for those guys. Look, at the end of the day, why do they do this? Because they've got all the money already, but the one thing that they fear more than anything else is a wealth tax. So, I mean, think about it this way. Why was it the opposition of Bernie and also Warren so vociferous, particularly amongst people who consider themselves to be the enlightened part of Democrat money? Because while they hate Trump, and they may hate what they see as his racism, his misogyny, the whole lot. At the end of the day, Trump makes their portfolios in normal times go up by 20%.
Right.
What is it that Bernie and Warren wanted to do? Actually take away their money and their power. At the end of the day, they will happily live under a Trump administration part two than give power to anybody that really wants to challenge their wealth and their power.
Do you think in the event that Biden does get elected that the what's going on in Europe in terms of the, you know, because last time we had this austerity that kicked in Europe, it seems to me like around 2010, probably.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And then that put pressure on, and there was also obviously domestic pressure, and he's surrounded by people like that. But then Obama makes that pivot in 2010, 2011. To austerity. They never quite get there as dramatic. They don't implement it as dramatically as Europe does. Europe
right.
turns into just a blinding disaster. And I think that probably, you know, convinced the Obama administration to sort of tap on the brakes with the austerity, and then ultimately sort of, I guess, you know, slough it off by 2014. Yeah. But do you think that starting out, if Biden gets into office, we'll be looking at a disastrous economic situation, that the fact that Europe is not pursuing an austerity agenda is going to help in terms of America not pursuing that?
I wouldn't say it that way. I mean, basically, until recently, the current administration, it tended to be that Europeans would pay a little bit of attention to what Americans were doing, but would ultimately do their own thing. Americans would never give a shit about what Europeans are doing and would ultimately do their own thing. I think that's still there. I think the way to think about it is as follows. When you had the financial crisis, the assumption was that unemployment and austerity were temporary prices to be paid for a long-term bounce back, the famous V-shaped recovery. The V never happened in Greece. It never happened in Italy. It never happened in Spain. At best, it was a U in Spain. And in Britain and other places, yeah, they bounced back, but that was because it was all London-centric. The provinces got destroyed. Similarly, in the United States, most of the austerity that happened wasn't at the federal level. The sequester was all a sideshow. The rounding error was at the state level. That's where the real stuff happened. So if you have 20% unemployment going in and you start an austerity binge, you will produce an extra 30% unemployment. So do you want to be responsible for unemployment going from 25 to 26 to 27%? Do you want to go at 30%? In the middle of the deepest recession that we've known since the 1930s, possibly, we'll see, if the economy can't restart as we hope, do you want to be the politicians that basically throw even more people out of work? I mean, ultimately, I think that the austerians and the Republicans understand that what they're doing is essentially the protection of their assets at the price of everybody else's employment. And that's not a game you can play when a third of the country doesn't have employment.
I hope you're right. Mark Blythe, William R. Rhodes, Professor of International Economics, Professor of Political Science, International Public Affairs at Brown, and author of the upcoming book, Angrynomics. When is that book coming out?
That is coming out June 17th. Columbia University Press. It's a dialogue between me and a buddy of mine, and it's for everybody. It's not for the academics. It's not for the policy wonks. It's for everybody who's listening to this show. Tells you what the hell's happened and why.
All right, great.
What we can do about it.
We'd love to have you back on after that comes out. Mark Blythe, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure.
All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half. If that wasn't fun enough for you. We've got some sound and other things to talk about. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, make it possible for this show to keep on chugging. If you are one of those folks who are you've lost your job, or you're, for whatever reason, you're going through any type of financial stress, send us an email, majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will hook you up. We will not lock anybody out of the show. It's been a longstanding policy. It's been the policy since day one. But obviously, it just applies to more people now. And do not hesitate. Do not feel in any way that you're asking for something that you don't deserve. Sometimes people are a little sheepish about it. And look, a ton of people have been where you are. I have been without work at one point. And do not procrastinate on cutting costs. Like I say, if you're a member too, and you're worried that the membership is going to become a financial strain, if you head over to our system and as you go through the cancellation process, you will get different options. So again, nobody will be locked out. If you're one of those people who can afford a membership and you're feeling confident about your financial situation, now's a great time to become a member. Join the majority report.com. Also, check out AM Quickie. Still doing it. You can sign up for it at amquickie.com. It is now living on our other YouTube channel, Majority Report Audio. You can find that at youtube.com/majorityreportaudio. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. It is what fuels me every day now, to the tune of an entire French press I have over here. Just keep it here in the corner. And I just, that's basically it. It's the only thing that's getting me through this, at least during the daylight hours. Nighttime hours are a little bit different. Wow, what's going on? My internet connection is unstable, it's saying. All right. Also, don't forget, what's happening at TMBS tomorrow night, Matt?
Oh, I'm not sure about that. I was just preparing my literary hangover plug. I can look, though.
Oh, wow. All right. Well,
but on literary hangover.
TMBS,
let's see. I'll do literary hangover first. I think you froze. I think I look fine. I think it's your internet, so we might have to sort that out during the break somehow.
Okay.
I think. Or am I freezing too? Oh, shoot. Looks like we might be having a little bit of trouble.
I can't tell if you're freezing or I'm freezing. This is our like little comedy routine. I don't know. I got a message that said my internet is unstable. I don't know why that was the case. All right. Well, so TMBS, you can check that out. Michael Brooks Show on Patreon, youtube.com/TMBS. Also, check out the Noma Key Show. You can find that at youtube.com, the Noma Key Show. Or I should say that's Nomiki Const. And you can go to patreon.com/the Nomiki Show, Nomiki Show. God damn. I don't know why I can say Nomiki Const. But I can't say Noma Key Show. I can't do it. Too many things going on. Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada?
Oi, I'm freezing over here. Can you guys see me and hear me?
You look fine. Yeah, you're fine.
Wonderful.
I think Sam's freezing.
Oh boy, put on a sweater. this week on the Antifada, we have an embarrassment of content, for you all. Today we released a new episode of History is a Weapon, which is a very excellent series that Sean does with the great Matt Chrisman of Chapo Trap House. This one, they look at the American landscape, current day, from the pandemic to the economic collapse, to the failing political system, and discuss how the hell we got here and what the hell we might expect going forward. So that should be pretty good. I'm sure that they both yell a lot in it, and that's for patrons. But if you can't afford it for whatever reason, just contact us and we'll help you out. Also, on Wednesday, we're releasing in our podcast feed the panel, in case you missed it, that Andy and I moderated on coronavirus and the future of work last week with Red May Seattle, featuring Aaron Bananov, Annie McClanahan, and Magali Miranda. And I think we had a really good conversation about that. I want to post all of those pieces in this blog post just so I can make everybody read them because they're so good. And then on Friday, we are cross-releasing an episode on Arrighi and world systems theories that Sean did with Terrence from our Kindred Spirit sister show, Trillbilly Workers Party. So that's three things we got for y'all this week, and I'm excited about it. Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
Matt.
Twitch.tv/literary hangover, folks. I'm playing Kingdom Come Deliverance, and I'm going. Sam, can you guys hear me? I'm playing Kingdom Come Deliverance and listening to Karl Kautsky. So, twitch.tv/literary hangover. Go there, folks.
All right. Going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. Be right back after this.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping.